the third in the series of Be Eager webinars. So I'd like to hand you over now to our presenters for tonight. So we have Kate Butler from Oncology Massage and Michael Alcock from Bone Training Australia. So good evening, people.
Thanks, Chris. Hello, everyone. So last webinar, we talked about the why of taking a history. So essentially, you can do PROMs, but without a good solid history, they're only part of the story. Writing up to a good case study is going to give you a good history. That way you can back maybe why things have happened as much as what has happened. So today we're going to revise the how of taking histories, because we realize that some of you have been in practice for a long time, maybe need a refresher. So some of this I did say last time, but worth going over again. So with a history, don't just throw someone a form, then do a quick scan of it and move on. A history should be a live conversation, because that allows for follow-up questions, for digging a bit deeper, for your antenna to go up on something they've said and follow up on that. And that's often where you get the really important stuff. Just having some yes-no questions on a form isn't going to get you to the nitty-gritty and the really important bits. When you're taking history, try to stay really agile and in the moment with that person. Be prepared to follow what they say. Go down that rabbit hole, because you may need to pursue something they've said and ask some follow-up questions, dig a little bit deeper, and not just move on. For some people, that can be a bit of a challenge. If you're someone who's very black and white and you like to do things in a very ordered way, it might take a bit of practice to get used to that way of working, rather than just working off your form, but it will really pay dividends with your people. Try to keep track of anything. If following the white rabbit, shall we say, takes you away from the next question on your form, just remember to maybe come back to that later, because there could be some important stuff there as well. But yeah, do try to stay with that person and stay in the moment with them. So for those who may be unfamiliar with those two terms, a closed question is a yes-no. Is the pain better in the morning and worse in the evening? That's a yes-no question. The better thing to say, so tell me about the pain. When does it get better and when does it get worse? Because that can lead there to give you much more about the ups and downs and the qualities of the pain. There are times, though, for a closed question, and that's when you get those people who might turn up with your 20-page printed medical history and they just talk, and you're never actually going to get them on the table. Sometimes you need to pivot to your closed questions to actually get some work done that day. So you can switch between both, but generally open ones are better. Now, people may come in with certain conditions. Try not to ever make assumptions based on what they're presented with. A simple one would be that an older person comes in and it's way too easy to write off a lack of mobility or joint pain or something as an aging thing. And it may not be at all. It can be something totally different. And it's the same with any condition someone might come in with. I have a lot of people who have Ehlers-Danlos. For some reason, I seem to attract them. And quite often, physios, doctors, etc., will just ascribe something to that without looking any further. So if someone tells you they have condition X, don't assume that they are experiencing Y. Everyone is different. We all have different experiences of different disease conditions and that sort of thing. So always ask them how it affects them. And that will make them feel like you really care as well. It's a very good way of building rapport with your person. And it's also a get out of jail free card if you're not overly familiar with the condition either. So how does that affect you is a way of pivoting it around, and then they talk about their condition and then you can run off and do some research later. So it's also a good little catch-all there as well. Don't beat yourself up if they don't tell you everything in the first session. Multiple reasons people won't do this. Sometimes they just don't think it's relevant, and so they don't mention it. And it could be the third, fourth, 10th session when they finally tell you that really important thing that makes you go, aha, and then work out your treatment plan and really get into it. So that's not necessarily on you if they don't tell you up front. And the other thing is that rapport takes time. So they might also have stuff going on that they're not talking about. So that could be mental and emotional stuff. That could be maybe some trauma or abuse they're not ready to talk about. But it can even be simple things where social mores prevent us. So they might not want to talk about urinary function or things like that. That can actually give you a signal as to what to look at. So there's a lot of things that may not come up that you would perhaps want to know. Also, people have this funny desire to please practitioners. And it's not just us. It's doctors, it's physios, it's psychologists. People want to please that person. So when you're taking that history, also bearing in mind they may be exaggerating things up or down. So you might ask about how much water they drink. Oh, I drink 2 liters. Always write down what they say, but mentally you can maybe take a little bit off that, particularly if they're showing all the signs of dehydration or how many coffees they have a day or alcoholic beverages. They might bring that down a little bit because they're a bit embarrassed about how much they have. So always remember that what they say might be a little off. Do write down what they say though. That's part of your legal requirement there is to record what they have told you. Now, a history isn't just about sitting there with a questionnaire and you asking stuff and then answering. It starts the moment you open the door and you say hello. You can often gauge straight away someone's state. You can read their face, their color, their eyes. They have bags under their eyes. Are their eyes flat and dull? Is their color gray or nice and pink? Are they stressed? Are their eyes darting around? Are they standing in a way that's guarding? If they're a little hunched over, that could suggest they're taking strain off a part of their body to take their pain down. You can watch and listen to them walk into your room. Is their gait even? If you walk behind them, you can actually watch their footfall and see if they're maybe lurching to a side or something. You can also listen to their footfall. Sometimes one foot will go down evenly, the other one will come down with a slap. That gives you an idea that something's going on there. So there's a lot of things you can pick up, not even just through questions, but using your other senses. Sometimes people will even come in and they'll have a slightly almost acidic smell, which often to me says dehydrated, they need to drink some more water. So there's a lot of little things that you can pick up that aren't about your questions as well. And just general demeanor, things like that. Well, now we're getting into collecting a bit of a subjective history from a person. So this is what we teach at BTA in our course as a way of collecting some relevant stuff. And this fits in with SOAP charting as well, that I know that the Fascial Connect people teach. So where? Really good question to start with. And always get them to point, because people have very funny ideas about where their body parts are. Don't just go off what they say, because it could actually not be the correct spot. I can illustrate that from when I was a baby therapist. I had this lovely older lady come in and she'd been seeing a physio for a year for sciatica. So I planned a treatment around sciatica. She came back and it wasn't any better. It only occurred to me on session 2 to get her to show me. And she pointed to her quads. And the quads aren't fed by the sciatic nerve. So she'd been seeing a physio for a year treating either the wrong thing or he aimed at the wrong thing or something. So it straight away changed what I was going to do. So do get people to point to a place. Onset. When did it start? So there's a few things to this. Was there a precipitating event? Did you do a thing and then it hurt? Or was it a case of I just woke up one day, or it came on gradually over a few weeks? That gives you a bit of an idea of, is this an acute injury? Is this something that's come on over time and they've built up bit by bit? Is it a chronic thing? So you can ask a lot of questions around the onset there. Consistency. When does it come and go? Again, that can give you a lot of pointers towards precipitating factors, things that they can change in their life. And also then it can help you with your treatment plan. Sometimes people will say that their neck is always worse first thing in the morning. That can lead to questions about, okay, what position do you sleep in? How old is your bed? What sort of bed is it? What's your pillow like? That kind of thing. Because if it's worse first thing in the morning, there's a good chance it's something that's happening overnight. Versus if it's fine in the morning and gets worse during the day, you can start asking questions about work and hobbies and sports and things like that. Because they may need an ergonomic assessment at work. Or if they play some sort of sport, they may need some lessons with a pro to change their form a little bit. So you can get a whole bunch of information from when is it better and when is it worse. Severity. So speaking of PROMs, a simple pain scale from 1 to 10 is a PROM. It is a patient-reported outcome measure. And what we're looking for there is not that we necessarily are going to understand their pain better, but so that we can track improvement or worsening or no change. Pain is one of those things that is purely subjective. There is currently no objective way of measuring it. They are trying to work them out, but we don't have anything because it's all about how that person's nervous system interprets the pain. So yeah, that's something that is important to record, but it doesn't necessarily help you understand their pain any better. So there's a big variance in what people have for their ones to tens. The next thing about pain is asking about qualities. Is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it stabbing? Is it burning? There's a whole bunch of different ways people can describe the pain. And that can also help you to understand how to work with that and what they may have going on. And it also helps you understand as it changes. Sometimes they might come in on session one and it's quite dull. And then over the week, it might get sharper as things regress. So that's something to always keep an eye on there too. And then looking at other areas of concern and does it relate to anything else? Because sometimes that secret sauce to getting one area better is actually somewhere else in the body entirely. So asking more broadly than just say their lower back pain or their neck pain can get you to the root of their problem much more quickly than if you just chase their primary thing that they've come in with. So yeah, asking about, are there other pains in the body? Is there other internal function? We're not naturopaths or anything, but with Bowen, we can affect internal functioning via the nervous system and the fascia. So asking what else is going on, because that can lead you to another way of looking at things. And also other things in life. Are they going through a very stressful period? Is there something going on at work? Is there something going on at home? Sometimes, again, it may take a while to talk about those things, but if they're open and understanding that's of interest to you, then you can pursue that. For taking a history, a very simple thing to look at is some postural observation. But a postural observation is a good baseline to look at for change. So you look at that and then you assess next week and see if it's changed at all. So here we've got a chat and you can probably just at first glance already pick a few things. So on that frontal view, you can see that he's actually leaning a little bit to his right. So his right shoulder is down on his left and they're all slightly off to his right. If you look at the gap between his left arm and his torso, you see there's a lot more gap there than there is on the other side. And the fingers on the right hand sit much lower against his thigh than on the left. These are all little giveaways you can have at first glance without even needing to get too close to anyone. But you can certainly then come in and put your flat hands on the iliac crests and get a bit of an idea, or find the ASIS and get a bit of an idea of where they're sitting. Put your fingers on top of the shoulders and gauge how high one is compared to the other. And then you can see this again from the rear view, the difference between the gaps between the arms and the torso. And then we come to his side views and you can see he's very much got that classic sort of middle-aged man lower back, very flat posterior pelvic tilt, not much of a curve on his butt or anything like that. And you can see how far forward his head is as well. The ideal for his ear should be over the middle of his shoulder and his hip, and he's quite head forward. So people who have done the PTA diploma will have learned further testing, but even in cert four, remember you've learned plenty of little tests. So you do your arm abductions for the shoulder, you do head rotations for the neck, you do the Patrick / Faber test for the pelvic. So there's a lot of little tests that you actually already know. So just always remember to stick within your scope so that you don't overstep when you're doing that sort of thing. And as much as we get consent for treatment, it's really good to get consent for your assessment as well. So some of these things, they're not overly invasive, but particularly if you're asking anyone to remove any item of clothing, make sure they're okay with that. They may not be. And a lot of this you can do through phones. It might be a little trickier, but make sure they're comfortable and that you've got their consent before you jump into it too much. So as I said before, we're not measuring to fix things. We're not chiros. We're not going to be pushing things to be anywhere they don't want to be. We're looking to be able to record change. And especially since BEGA is about research capacity building, that's a really important thing to measure. So regularly checking in to see how that change is going, because that is going to be the base of a good case study, is showing that improvement, as well as their reporting of how they're feeling and how their function is improving or their ability to do things in life. We've also got our measures of things like ranges of motion. But a good idea to not test them again at the end of the session. So remembering with Bowen, sometimes things get worse before they get better. So you don't want to get them off the table and retest that shoulder, because if it started to get worse, you're sending them out with a negative in their head. Always just say to them, look, we'll check that again next week. And by that stage, it's had a whole week to play out and for things to hopefully improve. But yeah, don't immediately retest them on stuff. And it's important to remember too, objective and subjective don't always line up. We can observe their function improving. We can observe that their range of motion is getting better. Their pain may not be though. So again, we're very person-centric in what we do. So what they say goes, always going with their experience of the pain as the primary indicator over what we record. And that can sometimes be a suggestion we may need to refer on. If we can see there's definitely improvement and the pain's not getting better, there may need to be some more investigation happening. But yeah, they don't necessarily go together. Similarly, their pain could go away and their function might not improve. It can go both ways. Now, when you're recording, you just need bullet points. You don't need to be writing essays, because remember, you need to come back and skim these notes later. If you've got 5 minutes between your last person leaving and the next one coming on, you don't want to have to sit there and read paragraphs of text. I try to use fairly standard abbreviation and procedure names. The reason for using standard stuff is that your notes need to be readable by someone else. So in the event that your notes are subpoenaed for a court case, and don't get scared, that doesn't mean you've done anything wrong. That could be the person that's been in a car accident and the insurance company is trying to prove that something was pre-existing. Your notes may be subpoenaed by the court, and someone else needs to be able to read your notes. You're not going to be called to explain them. You just need to hand over your notes. So they do need to be readable by someone else. So yeah, do use standard procedure names. Don't invent your own names for our procedures. And do use standard abbreviations when you can. Or just write things longhand, either one. Note any exercises or recommendations you give. You can't make someone go to a referral. You can lead a horse to water, but do note down if you have referred them on, because that's then on them to go or not go. So referrals, things like red flags, sometimes something will just stand out as not quite right. And it's a case of, I need to refer this person because something's clearly not as it seems, or it's suggesting something could be bad, outside your scope and serious, so to refer on, but also anything outside your scope, refer. And sometimes people do benefit from a multidisciplinary approach. You might want to share your person with a naturopath or a nutritionist or a psychologist or counselor, because Bowen's awesome, but it's not a panacea, and we do need to work with others on this. Record your plan. So note down when you want them to come back. Note down procedures you're considering for a next session or even for the next few sessions. Mark this stuff down. Okay, so we're going to get into some Bowen contras and cautions. So you've got some in your manuals already. So coccyx for women who were pregnant or potentially pregnant, TMJ after jaw realignments and jaw surgery and major dental work, and the chest and breast procedures on people who have implants. That's male implants as well as female. These are definite, but then we've also got cautions as well. Little things to keep an eye out for, where you may just need to proceed cautiously. Not saying don't do it, but just working very gently or feeling your way around before you get into it too much. So some things that are more modern that aren't in our manuals that you might want to look out for, things like Parkinson's electrostimulators. So people could have a battery pack in their chest and a wire running up to an electrode in their brain. You don't want to dislodge the wire. Similarly, you don't want to dislodge the wire on a pacemaker or an internal defibrillator. Some people with very bad heart conditions will actually have a defibrillator built into their chest. Check for things like pornocaths and PICC lines. So when people are having regular infusions, be it chemo or other infusions, they can actually have a semi-permanent port put into their chest with a little tube that then runs into a vein in their neck. Again, you don't want to go dislodging anything, so just working very carefully around those. Things like inserted surgical meshes. So again, fairly modern thing with things like hernia repairs. They're often using a mesh like a Kevlar kind of mesh. If someone's pelvis was a bit out of whack when that was put in, sometimes doing a pelvic on it can cause them a lot of discomfort, because if the body's trying to realign itself and it's pulling on the mesh, it's only going to be able to get so far. So again, not saying don't do the pelvic on someone with mesh, but just be aware that if they don't have a good reaction after that treatment, it may be something to avoid on them in future. Anything outside your scope of practice, again, think about maybe referring on or working very carefully. If someone's got excessive or unusual pain or an unexpected response after a treatment, again, think about referring on. I have a quite big example of that. Someone came with back pain, better after the first session, came back a bit. That's normal. Second session, next day she rang and she had quite strong abdominal pain, which didn't really fit anything I'd done on her. So I suggested heading to the doctor. And it turned out that she had ovarian cancer and it was manifesting as back pain. And the first she knew of it was from that. So things like that, if people have a very unexpected response or a total lack of treatment, do think about sending them on. So things like lumps and tissue changes, especially looking at your skin, your mole changes, things like that, do note those and refer people to get them checked. Infections. But again, you really want to be getting them on, particularly if their skin's very red or anything. It could be cellulitis, which is actually a very serious condition. I'd be sending them straight on. I wouldn't even be treating them. Again, sending them on to get that checked and maybe get some antibiotics, because that's very severe. Any bleeding, unexplained bruising, extremes of temperature, be that very hot areas, very cold. If their mood is very strange, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, rashes, it's a whole bunch of these things that can be cause for a referral. Things like undiagnosed edema. If it's diagnosed, that's fine. You can work with that. But if it's not diagnosed, or if there's very strange pains that may be neurogenic, do refer them on. Kate, your turn.
Yes. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Chris. Okay, so this is a review for oncology massage therapists, but we'll flip through them quickly. So pain, redness, heat or swelling may indicate a blood clot, infection or inflammation, all of which we steer clear of. We stay hand width away from medical devices, as with Bowen. A fatigue scale is a really good indicator of pressure and duration before the treatment. So that's in the planning stage. And range of motion is an important measure for scar work, but never go into the pain level where the range of motion is uncomfortable. Stop just at the edge of it. And before doing any scar work, ensure that there are no stop sign indicators before you start. So the other thing is, if you're doing scar work, keep in mind while we're ready to dive into it and free it up, there is potentially trauma behind it. And that's really important to check in with the person regularly during that work. And note the time spent on the scar and the techniques used in your notes. I've written a summary of swellings. So swelling and edema. If the client is on chemo and they have swelling of unknown origin, even if the clinicians are not that interested in it, we avoid it. And that could be because moving fluid around the body on chemo, some chemotherapy compromises the integrity of the heart. So best just to avoid it or get medical, written medical clearance to massage that swollen limb. If the client is on chemo and diagnosed with lymphedema, we can massage safely with the correct stroke direction for compromised lymphatics. If there's any combination of pain, swelling, heat, redness in an area with no history to explain it, avoid that area for that treatment and refer to the GP for a check. If lymphedema has been diagnosed and the area is red or hot, we avoid the entire limb, stop the massage and refer urgently to the GP. And that goes straight back to what Michael was saying about the risk of cellulitis. Even if it's not cellulitis, no one will be angry with you for being ultra cautious because, as Michael said, it's a life-threatening condition. If there's anything irregular, anything you're unsure about, just avoid that limb, treat other areas and refer to the GP before continuing on with that limb or that area. And again, we've said if it's known and diagnosed lymphedema, then we can massage that limb with safe stroke direction. So pain, often as massage therapists, the musculoskeletal system and all of the sources of pain. The musculoskeletal system is the system that's at the forefront of our mind, but with oncology, it gets a lot more complicated and we need to broaden our understanding of where possible pain sources are from. So be mindful of the source. It could be that there's nerve damage or nerve entrapment, very common post-surgical. It could be bone pain. And it could be that there are internal organs that are referring pain around the body. It could be neuropathy. It could be tumour. It could be as a result of infection. So, again, this comes back to taking a solid history and we need written medical clearance if there's any uncertainty about that. Best to be safe. The intake form is never enough on its own. It's like a prompt for discussion and follow-up questions. The questions that you ask actually are an indicator of your knowledge. So if you don't know very much about cancer, it'll become clear by the questions you're not asking. So those questions build rapport and confidence in the client who is aware of your knowledge base by exactly the questions that you're asking and the rabbit holes that you're going down. We break our complex health histories down into pressure site position and duration, which is a really good way of tackling a treatment plan for someone with a lot going
on. So remembering your confidentiality requirements. So everything you record, you need to keep private. So if you're using a practice management system, passwords, multi-factor authentication, if you're doing paper notes, under lock and key, please. So being very careful with your notes there. And we do have a responsibility for evidence-based practice. So your records need to back up why you've chosen your procedure and why you've done what you've done. And that includes giving them any exercises and things like that. So do consider that you need to have recorded stuff to justify what you're doing.
So one of the questions was talking about joints and replacements and things like that.
And so some stuff like a hip replacement, just remembering if you're doing the pelvic, don't go beyond about 90 with that. Again, with a knee replacement, just being careful about what range you take them through. They generally will have done a lot of rehab, hopefully some prehab as well, but rehab, and they should have a figure as to where they can comfortably get to. And just working cautiously. It's not a contra, it's just a caution. Yeah.